what we see now, that the fight for our independence and freedom is getting harder and harder every day because Russians are putting more and more resources into it. So as a result, it would be really good to match that with resources from the other side and help Ukraine in this fight.
On the 24th of February this year, Russia began its assault on Ukraine and changed the lives of millions of people forever, not only in Ukraine, but also in neighbouring countries and throughout the world. The legal profession galvanised itself to help colleagues and friends who were impacted, offering sanctuary, funds and employment, with the IBA pledging £100,000 to support initiatives in Ukraine. Funding has already been released to the two Ukrainian legal membership associations in support of humanitarian efforts in the country. In our discussion today with Nazar Chenyevsky, a partner at Sayenko Karenko in Kiev, we discussed how his law firm is operating, how they're supporting their staff, the role of the legal profession, and his views on the path ahead. Welcome to Sustainable Law in Action. And in this special episode, I am speaking with Nazar Chenyevsky, who is a partner at one of the largest independent law firms in Ukraine, Sayenko Karenko. Nazar is also vice chair of the IBA Technology Law Committee, and I had the pleasure of meeting him in person for the first time in Lithuania a couple of weeks ago. So, Nazar, it's great to speak with you again, and thank you for agreeing to join me and to talk about your experience and how you and your law firm are managing life and work during these very difficult times in Ukraine. So we're really grateful that you've agreed to join us. Are you still working at the moment? And if so, are you busy?
Yes, I would say the firm has been working all the time since the very first day of the war. Obviously, different people are busy at a different scale. I consider myself extremely busy at the moment, as well as all other senior members of our team, as well as members of the business support functions. Obviously, younger attorneys are not that busy because the volume of client work has dropped significantly. I can say that at the moment, we still have about 20 to 30% of our usual workload, while in the first month of the war, we had even less.
Nazar, I'd be really keen to hear a little bit about what was happening, I mean, within the context of your staff in your law firm and how you've sought to ensure they have other opportunities for work, perhaps working in other jurisdictions, which I know we spoke about when we met a couple of weeks ago.
Yes, indeed. As I mentioned previously, during the first months, the situation was extremely uncertain, and we could see already that we cannot carry on at the current pace, and basically we need to do some crisis management. And as part of those crisis management measures were some ways to decrease the burn rate. And obviously, it was a challenging task because on one hand, it was a top priority for us to retain the whole team. And on the other hand, we wanted to retain it in the long term, because obviously, if things go south and you keep making all payments as usual, you may not last for very long. So one of the creative solutions back then was to ask our friendly firms, like international law firms with whom we worked in the past, whether they would like to take some of our people on secondments. And I have to say that it worked really well, because with many firms, we had not only the business relationships, but we managed to build up a very personal relationship throughout the years. And it was especially true for many of my fellow officers from the IBA Technology Committee, because their firms offered such opportunities, among others. And on top of that, officers themselves, as well as some of their colleagues, offered accommodation for our employees who went to those countries.
So is that secondment process likely to last a long time? I mean, have you reached different agreements with different law firms?
The general approach, because initially, obviously, nobody knew how long it would take. So in most of the cases, the secondments were entered for the period of 3 to 6 months with the possibility of extension.
Yeah.
But we already see that some people would like to come back now. For various reasons, obviously, it has become safer, at least in Kyiv. Many of them left their families, either parents or their husbands in Ukraine, and they would like to reunite with them. And like the last but not the least, in some practice areas, there is more work coming up. And they have now what to do at other firms. So that's why they would like to do what they are used to do. And not everywhere is easy to integrate because obviously like all our people went to some nice big law firms. But again, it depends on the practice area.
Yeah.
If it is not that difficult for some of our M&A or antitrust attorneys to integrate in the teams working on some international projects. But it is quite challenging for litigation or white collar crime attorneys to integrate into foreign law firms because the legal landscape is totally different, and effectively they have to start from scratch or do some basic tasks which may not be that exciting.
This obviously applied because of the fact you work for a large international law firm in Ukraine, and I'm struck by the contrast for how smaller, medium-sized domestic firms may have had to respond to this. Do you know much about what your lawyer colleagues are doing who aren't so fortunate in the large international firms?
Yes, we are trying to keep in touch with the rest of the market. And I believe that has always been one of the peculiar features of the Ukrainian legal market, that most of the lawyers know each other very well and they communicate with each other despite being competitors. It's a kind of collegial atmosphere. And coming back to the issue of smaller firms, indeed, it has been much more difficult for them to find similar opportunities. And I know that the National Bar Association has been quite active in finding opportunities for Ukrainian attorneys or like their families to go abroad and like to find some safe place abroad. But it mostly was limited to the accommodation and some support on the ground, because in most of the cases, lawyers were not prepared to work in abroad, or they were provided the office space. But in many cases, smaller Ukrainian firms or individual attorneys, they do not have a very good command of English and or any other foreign language, maybe apart from the Polish. And as a result, it would be extremely difficult for them to start working in a legal profession anywhere else, unless there are some Ukraine-related projects. At the moment, there are not many Ukraine-related projects, because even those projects which have been in existence, they have been stopped. And we do not know if they would be resumed or when they would be resumed.
When we spoke, I remember you saying the concern is that those lawyers who haven't been able to continue their practice whilst going to other jurisdictions for safety may never return to the law. They may end up, you may end up losing perhaps a large number of the legal profession who've not been able to sustain their work. Is that a widespread fear?
In my view, there is another risk, and that risk actually relates to the people who can find some good jobs abroad, like people who have a very good command of English or German, and they can find a place in one of those big international firms. Because if such firms have multi-jurisdictional projects, most likely they would be interested in hiring people who can speak English and who have like good prior experience of similar projects. So it's not that difficult nowadays to requalify, especially in some countries which simplified the rules, like England. For instance, it is quite easy, I mean, from the bureaucratic perspective, to do a requalification for the Ukrainian attorney and become an English solicitor. So you just have to sit an exam, basically. And so many people may stay. On the other hand, the lawyers who have been successful lawyers in Ukraine and who do not have that international experience, most likely they would come back because they are used to certain standard of living, which is quite high generally. And obviously they cannot get the same standard of living in the country where they cannot work as lawyers. But the younger representatives of the legal profession, indeed, they may lose hope or like lose faith in the legal profession. And who knows, they may become software developers or they may become some entrepreneurs and just start working in other industries. And basically realize that those years in the at the legal school they spent, they were in vain, and they should now switch to another profession.
Just out of interest in terms of the work areas at the moment and what you're seeing in terms of how your business is changing, perhaps, are there new areas evolving, perhaps helping clients relocate businesses or working with foreign firms who are supporting Ukraine? Have you noticed that at your firm?
Mm-hmm. Yes, there are some new products which have become in demand solely as a result of the war. So our tax practice at the moment is quite busy with advising the clients on the new regulatory landscape, because the government has changed a number of tax laws in response to the war, like trying to simplify the rules. But on the other hand, while simplifying certain rules, which have been working for many years, they omitted some other regulations, which had to be changed as well, which caused quite a lot of confusion. And clients need some guidance here. Then we also help clients to deal with the mobilization issues. Basically, it's like army conscription, because especially in the first months, this conscription quite often has not been very selective. And there were cases when the company could have been crippled because, let's say, the top management was called to the army, which should not be the case, because generally under like common sense rules, you have to ensure that businesses may continue operating. And that has been one of the key messages of the government, that everyone should keep fighting on their own front, so to say. So businesses should continue doing business, like generating revenues and paying taxes to the budget. But obviously, the business cannot continue if some of their key employees have been called to the army and the rest of the people simply do not know what to do.
It brings me on to our next point, which is in relation to how law firms and businesses are responding to the crisis. So you've got obviously the changing nature of the business that you face, but also the changing environment in which law firms in general are now considering their business. And we've seen a large number leaving Russia in the aftermath of the invasion. And I'm interested to hear your thoughts about whether war should inform how a law firm operates and generally any issues that you think are potentially long-standing things that firms now need to take into account.
I believe personally that the war has become one of these checkpoints which like change our mentality in a way, because and it is especially relevant when we are talking about doing business with Russia, mainly because Russia has been blatantly violating international law and all important legal rules, which we as lawyers have been trying to protect at all times. And as a result, I believe that continue dealing with Russia will become one of these checks from the ESG perspective, like this, it's a kind of new environmental social governance, because companies who disregard these blatant international law violations probably do not care much about their own reputation, and probably their own codes of ethics are not that strict if they can allow doing it. And the same goes about law firms, because we understand that it's a very difficult question, because not everyone at the law firm, as well as not everyone of the Russian citizens, is supporting the regime. But on the other hand, there should be sufficient pressure on that regime, because if we try to exempt certain categories of businesses or certain categories of people, then such pressure would not work, because yes, there will be a small group of bad guys which are subject to sanctions, but everyone else would be quite happy and content. And that's what we had for the last 8 years after Russia invaded Ukraine in 2014. But nobody was doing much about it. And all major countries kept doing business with Russia, because they hoped, as I was told by one of my German friends, that by doing business with Russia, they would be able to contain Russia, because isolating it completely would make them angry. But as we see now, it did not help at all, and it only made them stronger, because they were able to earn more money during that period, to use that money for modernizing their military equipment. And they have become quite confident that such things can go unpunished. And I believe what we see now is a natural consequence of failure to act 8 years ago.
So what do you think about the current state and the value of international law in this regard, given perhaps the paucity of action over the last 8 years?
As we can see now, the current system of the international law or the world order is not functioning, basically, because the United Nations, as a system which was created on the verge of the Second World War, it did not prove to be effective, because the Security Council, which was supposed to be the place where all major world powers cooperate on keeping peace in the world, it simply did not work when it turned out that one of those countries is actually the perpetrator. And there is no legal means to influence such perpetrator within the existing framework. So, which for myself means that the United Nations system has become obsolete and needs to be replaced with anything else. Again, there may be different options for replacing it, but any such option would have to be backed up by some action, because we can't just replace it on the paper and in real life continue as is. And obviously Russia understands it as well, and they see that there is no legal way of stopping them. And for us, I believe it is evident that unfortunately, and I mean unfortunately for the legal community, but at the moment the only way to stop them is by brutal force. So you have to stop them physically. And obviously, one of the legal ways which may potentially be used, but I still believe that the national legislation of various countries would need to be changed for that, is going after the Russian assets abroad, basically assets of the state and of the state-owned companies in the first place.
Nazar, what sort of role do you see for the international legal profession in helping to reach accountability ultimately for those who've committed these atrocities, but also in then the rebuilding of the country in various ways? There's obviously a whole range of things that different lawyers who operate under different disciplines can do, but some of your thoughts on that, because it's a group effort. It's going to be a lot of help that will be required over the months and years ahead.
I believe that lawyers in every country are in a privileged position because they have a certain degree of influence over businesses in that country and the government in that country as well. And as a result, I believe it is really important that we have along our side lawyers from all countries represented by the IBA. And such lawyers would actually lobby the ideas we have been discussing so far. Basically, one of such ideas is discontinuing business with Russia and switching to the extent possible to doing business with Ukraine. And in order to do that, obviously, Ukrainian infrastructure would have to be rebuilt after the war is stopped, because I appreciate that not many businesses would risk investing into the country during the active phase of the war. At the same time, what is important to say is that Ukraine can offer equally big opportunities for any investors, and that is exactly what Russia now is trying to block.
And of course, in addition to that, there are the extensive efforts to bring accountability in terms of criminal liability, both domestically and internationally, which we will be watching with great interest as they develop, particularly seeing that there's already been a number of cases brought in Ukraine. With the first case, there was a guilty plea of a young soldier only a couple of weeks ago. So seeing some form of justice in action must be providing a level of reassurance, perhaps, to the Ukrainian people, would you say?
Absolutely. And obviously, the global support will be very important here. And one more important thing in that respect is that Ukraine is doing quite a lot on this front as well, including in the technology area, because IT industry workers are helping the government a lot, including with identifying all those perpetrators who were committing those atrocities in Ukraine.
Yes, I mean we've seen an absolute record number of verifiable videos, photographs, and audio files of alleged war crimes, which have been uploaded through the IBA Eyewitness app. Certainly helping demonstrate the sheer value of technology in seeking to compile a very hopefully valuable evidence base to bring people to account for what they've done, and obviously to facilitate good investigative processes. So it's been really good to speak with you today, Nazar. Thank you very much for joining us today, and I wish you all the best with things moving forwards, and wishing more importantly a speedy end to this horrific tragedy that's unfolding in your beautiful country. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks a lot for your time, and we are doing all we can to bring it to an end. So that's our main objective at the moment.